Good afternoon, and thank you for joining the Fulbright Scholar in Residence Last Call for Questions webinar. This is actually our second to last call webinar. We had feedback from institutions last year that two open hours office webinars would be useful closer to this deadline. So the goal of this session is to answer any outstanding questions regarding the Scholar in Residence 2019-2020 application competition. So my name is Tama Nicholson. I'm a Global Portfolio Officer here at the Institute of International Education.
And I'm Derek Cook. I'm a lead for professional development programs at IIE. I've worked on the Fulbright Foreign Language Teaching Assistant program with many institutions for a number of years. And going forward, I'll be the primary institutional contact for questions about proposals and proposal submissions. So very much looking forward to working with you all.
And we hope to be joined by David Levin, our colleague at the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs as well. So he'll be hopefully on the line a little bit later to answer some of the questions that might arise during the webinar. So as mentioned, the goal of this session is to provide an opportunity to answer your questions about the 2019-2020 Scholar in Residence application process. We'll save time for a formal question and answer period at the end, but please type in any questions that you have into the chat box. We'll try to answer questions in tandem with the presentation, especially any specific questions related to the application platform as we do a walkthrough of that website. During today's session, we'll provide a general overview about the program, programmatic insights from the State Department's perspective, trends within the program, some application resources, and attributes of a successful proposal. If you haven't already, I would encourage you to go back and review our archives, not now, but after the presentation, from some of the other webinars about the Scholar in Residence program. The previous webinars provide more detail into the program, and the first six were co-facilitated with previous and current SIR host institutions, peer review committee members, and even a couple of Scholar in Residence themselves. Just a quick note, the Scholar in Residence program is an institutionally driven program, so if there are any visiting scholars in the audience, please remember that the resources and tools that we discussed during this webinar would be for your host institution's use. Okay, so without any further ado, let's get started.
So I'll give a brief history lesson here about the Fulbright program, though I'm sure many of you are very familiar with this. The Fulbright program was established in 1946 under legislation sponsored by Senator J. William Fulbright. Though it's now a nearly 72-year-old program, it has remained vital to meet the needs of both the U.S. higher education community and the changing needs in regards to U.S. public diplomacy. This is foundationally a public diplomacy program meant to facilitate international exchange and create mutual understanding. Of course, Fulbright's a big umbrella program. There are many different components under the Fulbright program, one of which, of course, is the Scholar in Residence program, which we'll be talking to you a little bit more about today. The program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and is administered by the Institute of International Education's Council for International Exchange of Scholars, or CIES for short. Of course, we're very happy to have you all here today in the hopes of facilitating strong proposals and answering questions that you have to continue your engagement with this program, and particularly in regards to facilitating engagement among institutions that don't necessarily have the opportunity to engage with the broader Fulbright program in the same way as say an R1 institution might. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So as I was mentioning, SIR is a really great opportunity to bring scholars and faculty members from overseas to campuses that don't necessarily have that opportunity to host scholars, international scholars, or have a strong international scholar presence on campus or international student presence on campus necessarily. The purpose of the program is to facilitate exchange for scholars whose primary function will be teaching undergraduate academic courses either for a semester or a full academic year on a campus. So there is flexibility in terms of the program to meet either semester needs or academic year needs. SIRs, in addition to teaching courses, there's also a focus on ways that they will help internationalize campuses and internationalize your curriculum on campus. Oftentimes, the benefit of hosting an SIR is the establishment of exchanges with an SIR's home institution in their home country, and that can be a longer-term impact of hosting one of these scholars. Other things are virtual exchanges, online courses, research collaboration. So there's a really diverse set of benefits this program can bring to an institution, and we hope that in hosting SIRs, institutions really take advantage of the scholar's presence on campus to really think through ways that presence on campus can benefit during that academic year or that semester, but also in the longer term. Overall, I'm looking at the Fulbright Visiting Scholar Program. There are about 900 of them on campuses around the U.S. But again, what sets this particular component of the Scholar Program apart, aside from the fact that it is an institutionally driven program, is that the scholars are highly integrated into the campus and the community life, and that's a really core focus of the program. So the scholars are teaching full course loads. They should be engaged with the campus culture and the campus community. Oftentimes, the scholars are viewed as sort of all-stars, and they tend to be more visible than other visiting scholars who might often be really just focused on their research, be in a laboratory, and be less exposed to your campus community and your wider community. Again, the application is initiated by an interested U.S. institution. Again, as Hammond mentioned earlier, if there are any foreign scholars on the webinar who are listening in, you would first need to identify a potential institution who might be interested in hosting you as a component of their proposal, and the institution would be responsible for driving forward the application process. As you can see on the slide, this is a really great time to be talking about this because the application deadline is upcoming. The deadline is October 15th. We're also really looking forward to receiving proposals for review. We would encourage the submission of any proposals in advance, draft proposals in advance of the formal deadline. We're happy to give you feedback as you seek to create stronger proposals that are more competitive for selection for the program and hosting an SIR. We also have a lot of resources online. We'll talk about those a bit later. So we'll get into that in just a bit. So now we're showing you, again, the list of institutions that this program is really targeted to serve. There is a strong focus on making this program available to institutions that are, again, in the context of the Fulbright program, underserved by, you know, the broader Fulbright program, that don't necessarily have the resources to host scholars doing research or can't necessarily host, you know, Fulbright visiting students who are doing degree programs because, you know, it's a small liberal arts college that doesn't have, robust graduate-level programming. There's also, of course, a strong focus on minority-serving institutions. I won't go through the whole list here. You know who you are, but these are the types of programs that are types of institutions that this program is really seeking to serve. Now, of course, that's not to say that we won't accept applications from other institutional types. What we oftentimes recommend is if you're at an institution who's interested in hosting a scholar in residence and you're at an institution type that doesn't fall into one of these categories, think about partner institutions in your immediate community or in the wider community that you may be able to submit a joint proposal with. So that could be, for instance, a community college. You know, we know a lot of bigger universities have established and robust partnerships with local community colleges. There can be a space for a really strong proposal submission from a larger institution partnering with a community college to give that community college access to this kind of international perspective, to internationalize the community college's curriculum, and to provide that sort of international exposure and exposure to global perspectives to campuses where the student body is not necessarily going to be able to participate in those kinds of experiences on their own. So, of course, we would welcome partner proposals from institutions such as that. I don't know if David's on the line, but if he's not yet, we'll ask him to talk a little bit, too, about some of the benefits of the program. Of course, you know, one of the core benefits is, you know, increasing mutual understanding, broadly speaking, and also increasing globalization of your campus and your curriculum, and really feeding into any internationalization initiatives that might be ongoing at your institution. You know, another benefit here is to develop new coursework. So if you bring in a scholar who has expertise in an area that your existing faculty don't have expertise in, that person can, you know, work with you to create a syllabus for a course that could then be offered on an ongoing basis in the future. There's also, of course, the benefit for the contact with a faculty person from a different country and who's working in a different context, just to facilitate that kind of academic exchange. Looking at the institution more broadly, there's oftentimes continued collaboration between the scholar and residents and continued dialogue and exchange that carries on beyond the tenure of the scholar and resident at the institution during the grant itself. So now we're sort of looking at a slide of the overall timeline for the program. Again, I just want to emphasize that right now we're in a period that's where the application deadline is coming up fairly soon in mid-October, on October 15th. So we really do encourage you to submit any proposal drafts that you might have to our office for review. We're very happy to give you feedback to set up a time to talk with you on the phone individually about the content of your proposal, how you can work on elements of it to make it stronger, to make it more attractive for the external peer review committee that will convene in December. So we're really, really happy to receive proposals. We hope you continue to submit those to us. I know we have received quite a few so far. That's where we are now. October 15th is the program deadline. In early December, we'll convene an external review panel to go over the proposals. The committee will evaluate proposals for selection. In the case of proposals that name a scholar, the review committee will evaluate the proposal itself from the institution as to suitability for receipt of a grant, and will also review the named scholar for suitability separately. So that's an important detail to consider. Of course, we do encourage proposals that both name a scholar and proposals that do not name a scholar. So it's not a requirement at all to name a scholar in the course of your proposal. We can facilitate recruitment on our side of a scholar in line with the needs of your proposal. So that review committee meets in December. In January, we start notifying the institutional applicants of the outcome of the review panel to notify selectees of their selection and also to give feedback to those that weren't selected about ways to strengthen an application for a future cycle. From January to February, ECA and the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board also review recommended proposals for approval. Our office will work with institutions to confirm any funding support that's on offer. Also, beginning in that January period through April, this is also the period where we'll be working with our partners at U.S. embassies and Fulbright commissions abroad to facilitate any recruitment efforts for proposals, to encourage recruitment for proposals of those proposals that did not name a scholar. So we'll work with those offices overseas to handle that recruitment. And then once we get to April, June, that's when we'll start finalizing grants, sending grant packets to grantees, start facilitating paperwork for their arrival on your campus. And of course, they would be arriving on campus in August, September, in accordance to your academic year start, or in the spring, if it's a spring semester proposal. Again, there is flexibility here for single semester proposals. I actually just want to address a question that's come up as I was talking. So there's a question that says the guidelines state that if you want a specific scholar, you are not encouraged to apply. Is this true? So in short, that is not true, and I think there might be a misreading there of the guidelines, because we definitely do encourage submissions both from campuses that have a scholar in mind and also from campuses that have a strong proposal but haven't necessarily located a scholar or don't have the resources to locate a scholar. Again, part of the hope for this program is that it's bolstering efforts among institutions that don't have a lot of resources or international connections to facilitate this kind of exchange on their own. So both pathways work for strong proposals. Every year we have successful proposals from both types of institutions. Institutions that name a scholar in the course of their proposal, and institutions that do not have a scholar in mind. So there's a follow-up question that says, so is it okay to name the scholar all throughout the proposal? And certainly it is. I think the thing that you have to keep in mind is just that the scholar, him or herself, and the proposal are sort of reviewed independently for suitability for a Fulbright grant. So it could be the case that you have a scholar named in your proposal, the proposal is seen as a strong one that sort of meets all the criteria that we're looking for in an institutional application for this program, but the scholar may not be approved. I think Tamman can probably comment on how common that is, or you know, how often it is that a scholar is not approved and some of the factors there. Do you want to chime in there, Tamman?
Sure. I think it's fairly rare that a scholar would not be approved, but it would be in the situation where the scholar was found ineligible because they had previously been in the state very recently teaching, or in between when the application was submitted and when the grant was supposed to begin, the scholar had a change in their immigration status. Perhaps they now had a green card, they were now living in the States. And there's also been situations where the scholar who's been nominated for the program has a change and they are no longer able to come and conduct their SIR activities, and the institution has gone and found a second scholar, or we've switched it to recruitment, and we've reached out to our partners at U.S. embassies and Fulbright Commission. So there's a lot of flexibility in how the grant can be used, and I think the important part to remember is that it's an institutional grant. So if the scholar changes, the award is still given to the institution to internationalize their campus.
Yeah, and in some rare cases, there have been deferrals as well, right? So if something doesn't work out, and of course, you know, we're dealing with human beings, that can be for any reason. If something doesn't work out with a named scholar or something doesn't work out in the recruitment phase, you know, we can always work with an institution and our colleagues at the State Department to potentially defer a grant if you have already been selected by the review committee. So there is a lot of flexibility, as Tamman was mentioning here, to work with institutions based on their individual needs, particularly once an institution has been approved for a grant. We maintain a lot of flexibility because we know how much work everyone pours into sort of making something like this happen. So we're not too, you know, we try not to be too strict in terms of, you know, if something doesn't work out in some way, you know, let's say in the instance a scholar is not approved as a part of a named scholar proposal, we still want to work with institutions that have put together strong proposals. So we've talked a little bit about the review committee that meets. So because I understand you might be curious about sort of what this external review committee is looking for during their review process, we'll sort of talk about that just a little bit. So the committee convenes and is really reviewing to ensure that all the pieces of your proposal are coherent, that they're working together, and it gives a really strong sense of what an institution is hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. They review that both the short-term and long-term goals sort of line up with the proposal, that those goals are realistic, that this is not necessarily just a one-off, you know, opportunity to host the scholar, but that it is really integrated into your longer-term goals on campus, and that it will make an impact on internationalizing your curriculum, impacting your community, and really looking strongly at those components of the proposal. And that the scholar from, you know, in the case of a named scholar, that scholar in particular would really meet the needs of the proposal, or if you're seeking recruitment, that a scholar from that region or from that country, that there's a really strong case for why you're requesting, you know, someone from that country, someone from that region, and how that dovetails with some of these curricular goals or institutional goals that you have. So what we would encourage you to think about is really, you know, think through, you know, is what you're proposing feasible within the time period of the grant, you know, whether that be a semester, whether that be an academic year, whether the types of community outreach and engagement proposed are sort of robust ones and will make an impact, that there is strong campus support identified in the proposal, so it's clear that this isn't just the initiative of a single faculty member, but there is sort of a robust network on campus for a scholar once they come in to be supported, and that will actually help them achieve some of these goals. The proposal shows that, you know, there is a strong network at the institution to support the campus. Also that there are some sort of professional academic enrichment opportunities that will be presented to the scholar or that the scholar can take advantage of during their time on campus. And of course, a lot of these things, you know, they work together, they work in tandem. So the more you can draw those connections throughout the proposal for the review committee, you know, the stronger the proposal will be. We would also encourage you to take some time to think through the sustainability element of the proposal. So is this something that will have sort of reverberating impacts on campus? Is your faculty community broadly sort of learning from, taking advantage of this opportunity? Are they going to be involved in this? You know, are there ways for, you know, people in a department or across departments to engage with a scholar for fruitful dialogue and explore developments or areas of collaboration on campus?
I just want to touch on another question that we received about review criteria. And the question is, what kind of monetary or in-kind contributions does the university need to meet? Like, what are the expected obligations of host institutions? And there is no specific financial commitment that every institution is expected to provide as far as cost share. We know that every institution has different means, and we are aware that this is a different process at every institution. So we look at each individual application, and we encourage as much cost share as possible from institutions, and also creative ways to provide in-kind contributions, but there's no specific set amount that institutions need to offer in order to receive an SIR grant. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the application resources that we provide for institutions, including the CIES website, and I'm also going to walk through the SIR application. So I'm just going to jump out of the PowerPoint and move to our website. So if you haven't seen our website before, this is the CIES website, and you can find the Scholar in Residence program by going to Programs, U.S. Institutions, and then Scholar in Residence. On this page, you can find program deadlines and our contact information as well, and some of the information that we've already covered in this presentation. I mentioned the webinars. And all of our archived webinars are down here under resources, right on the main tab for the Scholar in Residence program. However, one of the most useful tabs, I think, on this page is our application tab. This is where you'll want to head as soon as you're ready to begin drafting your proposal. The resources on this page help to build the framework of an SIR application, and you can review essential aspects of the application like the eligible countries or even proposal considerations. You can see some more information about the institution served by Scholar in Residence. And at the bottom, you can also see some of the most recently awarded SIR institutions. So if you're looking at peer institutions or maybe institutions in your area that have hosted an SIR, you can check that link and maybe contact some of them for additional feedback about their process as a host and applying for a Scholar in Residence.
I'll just chime in here and add that, you know, if you notice there's an institution there who's in your area or that you're interested in talking to, oftentimes I think we can facilitate that connection to some of the people on that campus who may have been involved in the Scholar in Residence program, who may have been involved in that institution's application process, and that can be a fruitful conversation for you to have with those individuals because they've worked with their sort of campus networks and got different offices on campus involved. Sometimes they can answer questions sort of more concretely than we can because they've gone through the institutional bureaucracy and really worked through that in preparing a proposal for this program.
I just want to point out the application guidelines. You'll also see this link a lot through your application process. We highlight this a few different times because this is really your best tool as you complete a Scholar in Residence application. It's been designed to be used in tandem with the EMBARC application, and it's really your roadmap to a successful proposal. We've covered everything from financial support considerations to even common weaknesses cited by the reviewers, and every year we update the guidelines based on the feedback from the previous year's institutions. So I'm going to open up an application from there. To begin your application, you'll just click on EMBARC application, but because my screen looks a little bit different, it just made a bit more sense to already log in before this presentation. So you'll begin, easy enough, with the name of the individual applying on behalf of the institution and their email address. And once you submit that, the next line will again include, let me just sign in again.
Maybe while Tamman's signing in here, I'll just read a couple more questions and we can talk through them. So one question is that as for the country of origin of the scholar, is there any preference for a specific country or a specific region? And I think actually that's a better question for Tamman than it is for me. specific country? Is there any preference for a specific region or a specific country?
There's no specific region or country that would be preferred for the Scholar in Residence program, as long as it ties back into those pieces of your application that make sense for your institution. So we don't have any preference over where the scholar comes from, as long as it makes sense for the host.
Yeah, and I think the thing we're really looking at is does that country that you've named or does that region that you've named, does it align with the content of your proposal? I think that's the more important piece versus, you know, us looking for institutions seeking to host people from a specific country or a specific region.
All right, so we're back on track. I'm logged in again. I would actually encourage you to open up an application alongside me if you're not familiar with MBARC. This way, if you run into any technical issues, you can simply chat them in the question box and we can answer in real time. So after you fill out the name of the individual and the institution, we'll have another link to the guidelines just to reinforce that this is really something you should be using as you continue your application. And then the general information about the institution. So this is, for the most part, pretty self-explanatory about where your institution is located, your website, and then if this is a joint proposal with another U.S. institution. If it is, you would complete the name of this U.S. institution, and a second drop-down would populate, and you can check out the different designations that might apply to either institution applying for an SIR. And then the responsible administrative official will be the main point of contact for the team at IAE as we move forward with your proposal. So if we have any questions, or once the proposal is selected, this will be the person that we communicate with about anything related to financial considerations or questions about recruitment, just anything post the peer review stage. The next aspect of the application is the program dates. So you'd want to select dates that fall within the 2019-2020 academic year. And you can also build in a couple days for the scholar to come a bit early and get situated, things like obtaining a social security number and getting their housing settled. That's fine if there's a few days before the actual start of the academic year. And again, you'd put the principal contact for academic arrangements. So this will be someone who's going to be working specifically with the scholar. So this, in most cases, is their faculty supervisor or a faculty associate within the department. And further down, we ask for the financial support from the institution. So we'd want to know if you're offering a salary supplement for the scholar, and if you're not, or in addition to, what types of in-kind support, such as housing, meals, or professional travel to a conference that the institution will be offering. And this helps us to determine the level of support from the institution, but it's also useful in the situations where we are recruiting a scholar to be able to provide some of those additional support aspects that the institution is giving in addition to the Fulbright stipend. And then at the bottom, the total institutional support that is proposed from the institution. We also ask for the institution's appropriate salary ranges, just so we can determine where the typical salaries are for different professors and instructors at the host institution. And this is, I think, the fun part of the application, whether or not you are requesting a specific scholar. If the answer to this is no, then you just list up to two countries in one region where you'd like us to recruit from. I know that certain schools have said, we just want a scholar from Latin America and the country doesn't matter. But if you have a preference or there's specific countries where you'd like, this is where you would put that in so we can really focus our recruitment instead of just a blanket request, and we can have a little bit more specificity as we're reaching out to embassies and Fulbright commissions. And before we go any further, I'm just going to switch this to yes. And you can see if a scholar is specifically requested, you would input their name, their home institution, their address, pretty much their contact information that we can send to verify their availability and to check that they are eligible for a scholar in residence grant, their country of citizenship, permanent residence, their English proficiency as well. Typically, scholars are engaging with a broad range of people on campus and in the community, so we would want
to see that your scholar is proficient in English and they're able to carry out those wider range activities. And it's not just the scholar who has specific knowledge in a certain subject area, but they're able to engage with a wide community and fulfill some of the aspects of the Scholar in Residence program. So their English proficiency is a pretty key element of their eligibility for an SIR grant. And then if the scholar was a previous Fulbright lecturer or research grantee, this is where they can put in that information if they have experience in the United States, or if not, that can remain blank. And then we'd like to know how your institution knows a scholar, whether you've met them at a conference, or perhaps they've contacted your institution, or there's previous collaboration or an MOU between your university and the scholar's home university. So a little bit more information. I'm sorry, I went a little bit too far. So there is an option to put an alternate scholar. And this would be if you're unsure if your first named scholar is available, you can put an alternate. And that way, if that scholar is unavailable, we can look at the details for the alternate scholar. This is not required, but it helps to provide some backup information if the original scholar is not able to join your institution during the grant duration. And the last thing in this section that you complete would be any previous SIR awards that your institution has received, and the year, the scholar's home country of citizenship, and the discipline. And that way, if you're unsure, if your institution has hosted before, perhaps you're new, or there's been a long period in between interest in hosting SIR, you can also check our website or contact Eric or I individually, and we can look up to see historically if your institution has ever hosted an SIR. The last thing on this section is your proposal summary. So this is a very brief summary of your proposal. We use this to share with Fulbright Commissions initially to talk about your proposal and your idea for hosting SIR. So this is only 700 character limit. You'll have much more opportunity to talk in detail about your proposal and your ideas for your grant. But this is really just your elevator statement of why you'd like to host an SIR and what they'll be doing on your campus. Now the bulk of the proposal. This part is the institutional profile essay. So this is really your chance to tell your story of why your institution would benefit from hosting a scholar in residence. Typically, this is about 4 or 5 pages in length if you're applying on your own. If this is a joint proposal, we ask for 7 to 8 pages. And this is where you can tell us more about your institution. A lot of times, our peer reviewers aren't familiar with the host institutions who are applying to host an SIR. So you can tell us a little bit about your location, your demographic of students, the international opportunities and internationalization currently on your campus, and where you'd like to be long-term, and why it makes sense to host not only just a scholar-in-residence, but a scholar-in-residence in the specific discipline that you're applying for. The second part of the proposal is the proposed program and financial support. So this is the bulk of the proposal, the oversight, the academic program of the scholar, and your plans throughout the semester or the 2 semesters that they'll be on campus, the different outreach opportunities and professional enrichment opportunities, and how this grant will affect your campus in the short term and the long term. So this piece is about 8 to 9 pages for an individual institution, and we ask for 12 to 13 for a joint proposal between institutions. If it is a joint proposal, for any of these upload sections, we only allow one file to be uploaded, so just a housekeeping reminder that everything would have to be combined and then uploaded as one document. And I think, as you probably saw from my login, you don't need to complete all of this at once. Everything will be saved for your application. You can log back into Embark and complete your application anytime before October 15th. The next aspect of the application is the letters of recommendation. So these are only for named scholars. If you have a specific scholar in mind that you'd like to request, this is where you'll upload their CVs and their letters of recommendation. And we have this as part of your institutional proposal, so that way when the scholar applies later in the winter, they won't need to also submit letters of recommendation. This is already on file.
I think Derek alluded to it a little bit, that there's two application processes, one for the institution, and then if selected, the scholar would apply a little bit later. So this makes it easier on the scholar come the winter because we've already seen their letters of recommendation and their CV, and it's less documentation that's required on their end. The letters of support are the next aspect of the application, and we don't have any limit on the numbers of the number of letters of support that you can submit. I think the greater the number, the better, because it shows the wider plans for community engagement for the scholar. If you have this doesn't mean that everyone who submits a letter of support needs to engage with the scholar once they arrive on campus. And we do realize that things change, and there's a long time between when you apply and when the scholar actually arrives. So there might be a bit more excitement once the scholar arrives and in new departments and new community partners want to engage with the scholar. So this isn't anything that sets in stone what the scholar needs to be doing while they're on campus, but it gives us a good indication of who in the community and who on campus is in support of an SIR. So this is a letter from the responsible administrative official. This is really the person who will confirm the institutional support and authorize any funding on behalf of the SIR grant. So this is just a sign off from the institution and to verify that there's wider support and there's not just one faculty member who might be driving this proposal, and that it is an entire institution that is behind supporting an SIR on campus. The last aspect that we ask for would be a sample syllabi or a course outline of the courses that the scholar in residence will be teaching or will be engaged in. So just any course outlines, course descriptions, or sample syllabi that help to assess what the academic components will be for the scholar in residence while they're on campus and what they'll be teaching. So again, if there's not a specific course that is in mind, or there might be a few different options, you can certainly submit all of them and include in your proposal what the idea would be for a scholar. I know sometimes if we're not sure if a recruitment request is going out, there might be different specialties that arise based on the scholar that is eventually recruited. So inevitably, we might need to change what some of the plans are for teaching. But this is just the sample and outline, and helps us to outline what the academic goals will be for the scholar in residence. And the last tab is where you can review all of the missing documents. As you can see here, there's a lot of missing documents that haven't filled anything out. But if you see there's anything else that's needed, this tab is useful as you can check the percentage of the application that has been completed. Okay, so I'm going to jump back into the presentation unless there were any questions about MBARC that popped up.
Let's see.
There were a couple questions about sort of requirements in MBARC. So there is a question here. So we notice the application instructions do not mention all of the required information, such as the scholar's experience in the U.S. and so forth. So is there a PDF or simple list of all the required info that will enable us to prepare all of it before entering into MBARC? I mean, I think the application instructions probably include, you know, most of what we're looking for in terms of the MBARC application itself. I mean, of course, as Tamman was just mentioning, you can always create an account in MBARC and sort of look through the data, look through what's there. I mean, that's the most complete inventory of requested information, right? Because you can see all the fields that are there, you can see all of the information that's requested that you'll have to go through as you make your way through the application. But those application guidelines are fairly complete. Tamman can comment on if there's anything else.
Yeah, I would use the application guidelines, and I guess it's possible there might be a few differences between the guidelines and the actual application. We've done our best to go through and make sure that everything is covered in there, but I think Derek's advice is spot on to create an account and to log in so that there are no surprises come October 15th and you know that everything is submitted and you have all the information that's needed to move your application forward for peer review.
Yeah, there are some other questions here that aren't specifically about Embark, so I think we just have like a couple more slides to go through, and then we can go through the questions.
Yeah, I think we were the next slide is a little bit more about the Outreach Lecturing Fund, but we can answer some questions and then talk more about OLF.
Okay, sure.
Afterwards.
Yeah, so there's a question here about how many courses is a scholar expected to teach? One course or a full load?
Scholars typically teach 1 to 2 courses a semester. So they're not teaching a full load like a typical faculty member would be, because we want to make sure that the scholars have the opportunity to engage in the community. So the typical course load for a scholar would be 1 to 2. I've seen a few proposals, which I think is wise, that the scholar is maybe not teaching any courses in the first semester or the first quarter, and they're engaging with the campus and they're working on course design, and then as they get a bit more comfortable and they're a little bit more familiar with the campus body, then they're teaching 2 courses or a little bit more. So sometimes those courses are backloaded to make sure that the scholar is able to get their feet wet on campus first.
Right, yeah, and so if they're teaching, you know, 1 or 2 courses, whether that's, you know, both semesters or in the spring semester or only 1 semester, depending on the structure of your proposal, you know, the idea is that, you know, that other time that they have is really rounded out by the engagement piece, you know, engaging with your community, engaging with your faculty, engaging with your students, and also by, you know, whatever professional development or activities they want to engage in on their own. So doing research, working with other faculty, creating those connections, that should be rounding out that time that, you know, otherwise might be dedicated to teaching a 3rd or 4th course. So 1 or 2 courses is pretty typical, and that's generally what we're seeing in applications. There is a related question, a somewhat related question that came up a little bit earlier, which is that the individual that an institution has in mind is a professional, so she's not an academic. She doesn't have teaching experience. Is teaching a necessary condition for a successful application? And I'm not sure if that means teaching experience for a scholar or teaching as a component of the proposal. So maybe you can address both.
Yeah.
Both, Tamman.
Typically, SIRs will be teaching undergrads on campus. That's typically what their role is, because it provides the widest access to the campus community. But that doesn't mean that is all they can be doing. So if there is someone who is a non-academic professional and they can engage with the wider campus in different ways, maybe they're helping on course design or they're helping with different types of academic-related events, then I think that would be acceptable if they're not teaching a class and if they don't have academic teaching experience in the past. I think it would depend more on the goals of that proposal, and I feel like this might be a specific situation where I would encourage you to reach out to the team and we can talk specifically about the goals for your proposal and how we can best align that so that it's a successful submission.
Right, yeah. So if you have a draft that you're working on, you can feel free to send that to us, or if you're sort of, you know, you've been working through this with offices on campus and you just want to talk it over with us about what your sort of prospective plan is, we'd be happy to sort of give you that individual feedback. So there's a question, there are a couple questions here sort of in the same vein about proposals and making strong proposals and what's sort of acceptable and not. So let me go through that first. So we talked about teaching, and then there's a question here about, so there's an institution that is currently hosting an SIR, and they're asking if we can give them a sense of how much a second consecutive application might be discounted in comparison to someone who's not currently hosting. And then they're also asking if they should wait another year before reapplying.
So if there's an institution who is currently hosting an SIR, that wouldn't discount their application from being considered for a future cycle. If the institution is interested in hosting an SIR in the exact same department or from the same country or world region, I think that's something that the peer review committee would take into account, because we want to make sure that the current SIR who's on campus is helping to progress the internationalization of campus. But a lot of institutions are wide-ranging and have a lot of different faculties involved, and one SIR might spur other departments to want to internationalize, and other aspects of the campus can then join on. So I think it would be taken on a case-by-case basis, but if it's a different department, if it's a different country, and it's a different focus, then that's not something that the committee is going to discount. They're not going to eliminate the application because it's the same institution. And we do have a lot of schools who will come back to the SIR program every few years because it helps to internationalize their curriculum. And we have other schools who will apply 2 years in a row because it makes the most sense for them. So I would encourage you to still apply, and we can, again, talk about how to differentiate this application from the previous application.
And then there are a couple of questions that are somewhat related to funding or resources on campus, so I'll go to those. The first is, who pays the scholar's salary?
So the scholar will receive a stipend from the Fulbright program, and they'll receive a settling in allowance and then also a professional development stipend. But we do encourage institutions to also provide cost share if they're able to. It's not a requirement, but if we are recruiting for a scholar, those additional benefits do help to encourage scholars to apply and to come to your campus. But I think the short answer is that the scholar will receive a Fulbright stipend from IIE and the Fulbright program.
And then sort of in the same vein about sort of resource constraints, any suggestions on housing? We're a community college and don't have dorms on campus or any housing partnerships that we could utilize for a scholar. The anticipated scholar would be traveling here with his wife and 2 children. Any ideas on what other grant recipients have done for housing?
I think we've seen a variety of housing options for scholars, and we've seen scholars who've stayed on campus, and we've seen scholars who have stayed in the place where maybe a faculty member on sabbatical typically lives and they're gone for the semester, or we've seen the institution help to secure housing and help to bridge those connections. I think that my initial advice would be to reach out to as many community members as possible and then discuss some of the logistical arrangements for hosting a scholar in residence, because that could be, there could be a lot of partnerships that come out of those initial conversations, and we can also help to connect you with institutions that have been in similar situations or in similar demographics where they might not have housing on campus, and to utilize their advice and their expertise.
Yeah, I think this might be a case where, you know, if you're sort of, have you been thinking about this issue and you feel that you're running into roadblocks, this is a case where we'd be happy for you to reach out to us sort of individually, and maybe we can connect you with another community college that has had to deal with this very same issue, just so they can give you some feedback about how they got around this problem of, you know, housing that's going to be convenient for a scholar, that allows them access to the campus, even transportation issues, that sort of thing that might be more, that may come up more at a community college than at other institutional types. There is, going back to Embark, there's a specific question here about an Embark account. So someone's asking, do we use our existing account or should we create a new one for SIR? I think if you have an existing account, you should be able to access the SIR application. Is that correct, Cameron?
Yes. If you have an existing account, you'll apply through a different link, and both of your applications will populate, and you'll just need to make sure that the SIR application is the one that you're using, but no need for a new account.
Yeah, because the account's attached to your email address, you can just use that same email address. It's more important that, you know, you're using the correct link. I think that's the key thing. And I don't think we have any other questions at the moment.
We have two other questions that came in before the webinar that we might as well address now while we're answering some questions. So the first one is from an institution that has 2 potential candidates, one from France and the other from India. And their question is, what is the time duration and compensation for both of them? So I think that we've talked a bit about compensation, but it wouldn't change depending on where the scholar is from. It's still the same stipend that would be provided to the scholar. But I think the larger question about 2 potential candidates, you can apply twice as an institution during the same cycle. So you can submit an application for your candidate from France and the candidate from India, but only one will be funded. So it's basically 2 different SIR applications that you would be submitting to us, and we will
present both to the peer review and one would be selected for funding because the idea of the SIR program is just for one SIR on campus at a time.
And then there's another question here, which we've covered this during the presentation, but just to reiterate, so the question, this came in before the webinar, was about the required minimum. So is there a required minimum of 3 months in country? And if that's the requirement, could that period of time be broken up into two shorter stays, which then add up to more than 3 months?
The answer for this one would be no. The goal of the program is for the scholar to be as engaged as possible with the campus community. So two shorter stays doesn't really provide the time for a scholar to have the access to campus and typically doesn't provide the opportunity for the scholar to be engaged in courses or to teach a course.
Yeah, it is meant as a sort of longer engagement and a deeper engagement versus a shorter duration program. There's another question here getting back to sort of stipends and resources. So the question is, does the stipend amount for the scholar vary depending on the local cost of living?
It does. So the stipend will vary depending on the location of the institution.
Right. So the way this works on our side is essentially the Department of State does a survey of cost of living every few years. They give us figures that are specific to various locations. That's the information that we're using when we're determining what stipend to pay the scholar who's coming in.
And additionally, the scholar will receive a small stipend in addition, or a small monthly amount if they are traveling with dependents. And the dependents are accompanying them for at least 80% of the grant.
Right. There was a sort of bigger picture question that came in, which is how many institutions are you anticipating funding for 2019-2020?
For 2019-2020, we're anticipating funding between 30 and 40 institutions. I think the exact number is not set in stone yet, but that's our goal for 1920.
Yeah. And some of this, I think, will depend on how many strong proposals we receive. I mean, if we receive more very strong proposals in that number, that will, I think, engender some conversation about funding and whether there's funding support available to fund those grants. So again, as Hammond mentioned, that number is not set in stone, and we're definitely looking for as many strong proposals as possible.
And I think just to add to that, it also depends on the length of proposals. If we see a lot of proposals that are submitted for one semester grants, then that allows us to spread the funds a little bit more. But if there's a lot of full academic years, then that number's a little bit lower.
So I haven't seen any more questions come through, so maybe Tamman can move on through this slide, and then if there are any questions that are sort of bubbling up in your mind, feel free to type them in and we can always return to them.
And yes, please do submit any lingering questions you have. So just to talk a little bit about the Outreach Lecturing Fund, as I mentioned before, as Derek mentioned before, there are 900 visiting scholars at any given time in the U.S., and these scholars include SIRs, they include research scholars, they include others who are doing different types of subject research and teaching. So they are the Outreach Lecturing Fund allows you to, as the institution, apply to host these scholars for short-term lectures. I think of it as a mini SIR. So if you're sitting through this webinar and thinking that maybe you'd like to host a scholar on a short-term timeline to get an idea of what it's like to host a scholar first, I definitely recommend using the OLF program. It's a nice way to get your feet wet on what it takes to host a scholar on a short-term basis. The scholars typically provide lectures or they meet with faculty members and students or different community organizations on a different range of subject matters and a different range of ideas, but it's typically 2 to 6 days is the length of a typical OLF experience. And if you're looking at hosting a scholar, you can check the online scholar directory for the list of all of the scholars who are currently in country. So this is our last slide, just our contact information. You can check our website again to see more information about the SIR program or contact us at sir@iie.org. And then I don't believe David's on the line, but David has provided his contact information if you do have any questions and you'd like to directly reach out to David Levin at the State Department.
can see his email address and phone number right there as well.
Yeah, and I haven't seen any other questions come through. So if there are questions that come to mind that you wish you had asked us during this presentation, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Again, we're very happy to provide whatever insight we can and the things that are coming up for you. Again, and then just one more time, I'll emphasize that as you start putting together these proposals, please do take advantage of our offer to review drafts. That'll only help you craft a stronger proposal for the review committee and increase your chances of having a proposal approved. So thanks, everyone, for making the time. I think, Cameron,
thank
we
you.
Can close it out.
Thanks, everyone. We look forward to seeing your proposals.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, everyone.